This is Bart Weiss.
This is Chris Reed.
This is Summer Garber.
And this is the Fog of Truth.
Truth and fact in documentary cinema, lessons of darkness.
This is the Fog of Truth.
Reality is delicate.
I don't care who did it, man. I just want to know who did it.
He's going to tell me I'm small, that I'm young, that I'm inexperienced.
Let's just do it as human beings.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Fog of Truth. This is episode 801, kicking off the eighth season. And this will be dropping in the middle of Park City Madness, Slam Dance, Sundance. And we thought it would be great to bring back an old friend. But first, my name is Christopher Llewellyn Reed, and I am lead film critic at Hammer to Nail, associate editor and critic at Film Festival Today, and chair of the Department of Film and Moving Image at Stevenson University. And with me is Bart Weiss. Tell us something about you, Bart.
I'm Bart Weiss. I'm the founder and director of Dallas Video Fest. I teach University of Texas at Arlington. I'm making a few films here and there. And I produce a TV series on KERA Dallas called Frame of Mind, which is a program of Texas independent cinema.
And in our third chair today is our former co-host, Summer Garber. Welcome back, Summer.
Hey. Wow, you guys have really perfected that intro. Hi, I am Summer Garber. I'm the co-captain for the Doc Feature Programming Committee at Slam Dance.
And that's why not only did we just miss you and want you back, but we thought you'd be the perfect co-host for this episode because you're going to tell us about the 2020 Slam Dance documentary features, are you not?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite topics of conversation lately, so it works out well.
Before you do, can you tell us what you've been up to since we last heard you?
So I'm the director of operations at the Silver Lake Jewish Community Center, and I've launched a screening series that we're calling the Silver Lake Film Society. We've successfully done 3 screenings right now. We're planning our 4th for February 13th, the day before Valentine's Day. We'll be showing 8 shorts themed around queer love stories. So if you're in the LA area, I encourage you to come check that out.
So both Bart and I have seen some of the films that you programmed for this year's Slam Dance Film Festival. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the slate?
I was going to just run through a few of my favorites, and maybe we can talk generally too about the process. Slam Dance is a little bit unique because we're programmed almost exclusively by alumni filmmakers. So we kind of have a rotating crew of programmers on our doc feature committee every year. There's, you know, a few people who have been with us now like 6-7 years. And then we have some people who will kind of come in for a year and then go out to work on a film and then maybe drop back in. So there's always an interesting like rotating cast of characters every year that's been enjoyable. This is my 8th year doing it, but we're really excited about the slate this year. I was going to go down alphabetically, just I had jotted down some notes about a few of my favorites that I had sent you guys. First, I personally really loved Bastards Road. I feel like we don't see a lot of veteran stories. Also, I watch a lot of film submissions. Like I watch, you know, probably over 200 doc features a year. And Bart, you might know about this too. I feel like there's a trend all the time of people walking across country. That's really...
That's a genre movie. I mean, it's like when you watch a lot of films, there's like 20 genres.
Yeah.
And yeah, so, you know, and Chris, what was that film that we talked about the guy in New York who was
walking? We did that one. I was on that episode.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that film was The World Before Your Feet, but there was also a documentary, I think about 3 years ago, called Almost Sunrise, about 2 veterans who have PTSD walking across the country to help veterans combat their suicidal tendencies. So It's certainly not the first film about this. This is a film by Brian Morrison. It's not an interesting summer, but it's definitely a topic that's been tackled in some ways before.
I hadn't seen anything like it, so I was really moved. And also, I'm really cynical after watching so many submissions. I see kids in India sniffing glue and, you know, all kinds of weird and terrible atrocities. And I, by the end of the process, usually feel nothing. But I watched this near the very end and I was like a puddle of tears. And I thought that said something about it. And the committee seemed to agree. So that's good.
Combat, I'll take that last little piece, that piece that you thought the world is kind of an okay place. Combat takes that from you, and you'll never get that back.
They lose part of themselves when they go to war, and we just hope that we can help them get all those pieces and parts back together.
A Maryland man has been walking across the country since last year.
9,000 kilometers, what, 5,800 miles? That's a lot of lonely road out there.
Once you're home, you think it's over. It's just beginning.
You go off to war and you're going to be asked to do unspeakable things. To think that you just went over and did your job, that's pretty ignorant.
I don't think we're looked at as patriots or heroes. I think we're looked at as damaged goods.
Big Fur, we all love, which is about a taxidermist who specializes in recreations, and he's a firm believer in Sasquatch, and the film is about his recreating of a Sasquatch. I love anything with Sasquatch, basically, always, too.
You like cult films and anything with Sasquatch. The film you have to make is a film about a Sasquatch cult.
Ah. Oh. That'd be great.
So this is by director Dan Wayne, and I also enjoyed The Summer. Thanks for sending it my way. Although I thought it was a little bit all over the place at times, but the character, the central character, the taxidermist, Ken Walker, is really fascinating. So I enjoyed getting to know him.
Me as well. I thought, you know, it's with many of these things, so much is about, do you like the character? Like with the veteran, he's an interesting character. The character's qualities are important. And I also think the idea that he's sort of an artist working in a world where, let's say, things are right-wing and arts aren't really appreciated in taxidermy really put him in an interesting place.
He says that at one point. That's a direct conversation he has with somebody at one of these like conventions or whatever.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, don't you think it's weird that like these guys are all basically artists, but they hate art?
Yeah.
He took the taxidermy world by storm. People look at Ken as the Elvis Presley of taxidermy, if you will.
Ken Walker of Alberta Beach, Canada, with the wallabies.
Taxidermy is the most difficult art form that man has ever devised.
That's right, but you know what the funniest part is? It's all done by right-wingers who don't even believe in art and don't even know they're artists.
Ken was always interested in animals. He was just a little guy, walking around with a jar full of bugs.
When I was in grade 3 or 4 or something, I wrote a story about Bigfoot. The thing that I find most frustrating about it is I know the creature is real. I am convinced, and I'm going to go one step further and build a model.
And then speaking of interesting characters, Jasper Maul is the next doc I wanted to talk about. And this is about a dying suburban mall, of which there are many across this country. And the guy who runs it, who's a really fascinating Australian dude named Mike, and all the characters who inhabit this space. It's kind of observational and quiet, but just, I thought, really lovely.
Yeah, this is from directors Bradford Thomason and Brett Whitcomb, with whom Bart and I actually just recorded an interview, which we will cut to in a moment. And it's a really fascinating documentary in so many ways. I really, really like this one. You mentioned that Mike is Australian. They never directly address that in the film. And for the longest time, it was killing me where his accent was from, because it's so tinged by now with Alabama, which is where the film takes place. Sometimes he sounds very Southern. Other times he doesn't. It was a really interesting accent. But he's a fascinating character, this caretaker of this guy.
Yeah. He's both like just cleans the place and is also running the business, and he's doing the whole thing himself, and he sees it dying before his eyes. Yet he is like unstoppable. It's like just keeps going.
And he walks us through these abandoned anchor stores of JCPenney and Kmart, and it has sort of an almost Shining-esque feel where he's like, you know, he's not just a caretaker. He's always been the caretaker.
Yeah, there's two moments I just love where he's interviewing the kid who's maybe going to come work there, and they're walking around in the bathroom, and he's like, yeah, so a lot of times people just don't poo in the toilet, so that's your job, you know, you've got to clean that up. And then they're at the desk, and then cut to like this really genius editing moment where they're at the desk, they're signing the paperwork, and he's like, so it's like $8 an hour or something, right? Like, it's like nothing. It's just, ugh. Then there's a scene on the merry-go-round where this mom and the kid doesn't want to go on the merry-go-round, and the mom is just delusionally being like, it's fine, it's fine. And the kid is just increasingly like freaking out, grabbing onto the mom, being like, we're all gonna die, like as the merry-go-round starts, and the mom's just completely unfazed. And it's just like, that's the world right now. I related to that kid so deeply.
And as the mom is saying, you wanted to do this, you were crying to do this.
You'd be surprised how many people that tell us every day how they feel safe come up here and walk, and they tell me they remember when it opened up the first day here. Some of them still coming. So that's a good thing. But I wish it was like it, you know, when they said it first opened up, they said you couldn't even walk in the mall. There were so many people in here. So maybe if something opens back up, we'll get them in here. It'd be nice.
Here we are with directors Bradford Thomason and Brett Whitcomb of the wonderful slam dance documentary, Jasper Mall. Gentlemen, welcome to the Fog of Truth.
Thank you. This is Brett. And this is Bradford Thomason. Thank you so much for having us.
Well, we both really liked your film. This is not your first collaboration. You've done some great work together, including the 2012 documentary Glow, the story of the gorgeous ladies of wrestling, which helped inspire the eponymous Netflix series. So I'm curious, how did you two first find each other and decide to work as a team?
We were both actually DJs in Houston, disc jockeys. Like, not, we didn't talk or anything on the radio. We both like were mixers on turntables and stuff. And I actually worked at Guitar Center with the plan of needing a DJ to land a DJing gig. And Brad came in one day and bought some DJ equipment, and I was like, hey, are you a DJ by chance? And he said yes. And I like kind of begged him to like hook me up and give me a night at the club he was at. And this was in 1999.
Yeah,
or the year 2000, and we met then, and then DJed for a long time, and then we both kind of segued into filmmaking together.
Well, that's a great story. So, if you talk about your filmmaking process, I mean, to me, there's this wonderful sense of verite filming, that where you're seeing things and absorb them. You want to talk about like how you, once you pick something, how are you process of making the film?
Well, I think, you know, first, we kind of scouted the mall, and it felt right sort of right away because it was small and manageable, and it felt like there were enough characters, even just kind of walking around the first time, that we could see the same people when we went. And then it was kind of like, well, let's figure out who's interesting, you know, who might, you know, give us, you know, an arc as we go on with this thing. And then, of course, you have technical hurdles to get over, like how you're going to film in a mall for, you know, 8 months or whatever, and what you have to do to make that happen. But we just, you know, we just jump in and find, you know, talk to a lot of people. You know, Brett talks to a lot of people, and we just find the ones that we feel like are going to make for interesting filmmaking, you know, that we connect with.
Once we found Mike, who's the security guard and manager and kind of jack of all trades of the mall, once we found him and started spending some time hanging out with him, you know, we knew that, you know, it was something special. And, you know, we do that without cameras for a while before we come in with cameras.
You clearly have an eye for observing people out of the mainstream and letting the setting, as well as their particular drama, tell the story. How did you find the Jasper Mall and decide it would make a good doc subject? Were you living in Alabama, where the mall is located?
Yeah, it's about 45 minutes. I think it's 45 minutes northwest of Birmingham, where we are right now. And, you know, I don't exactly remember. I think I was looking at a blog. I was kind of immersed in looking at a lot of mall things, like dead mall, dying mall websites and things like that, just reading about malls, because, you know, like all of our films, it kind of started from nostalgia and sort of memories of our childhood being in malls. And I saw the Jasper Mall listed somewhere, and I saw a few pictures of it inside and was like, wow, that looks like it hasn't been remodeled since, you know, the early 80s. And sure enough, it hadn't. I think one day I was driving up to Memphis or something like that and just pulled in and walked through and sent Brett a bunch of photos of the mall. And I was like, look at this place. And, you know, we both were immediately like, this is a good, it has the look, at least, you know, before we started doing all the other stuff.
So how did you convince, what's the guy's name, who's the security guard and manager and everything in the mall, to be in this? And were there any people who you wanted to get in the film who didn't agree to be in it?
Mike's the nicest guy ever. So he just like, he didn't even care. He was just like into it. We actually probably made it more weird than he did when we first told him what we were doing. We were like, you know, this might sound strange and, you know, but we're filmmakers and we really are, you know, drawn to this place and we feel like it has the aesthetic that we like. And we feel like if we spent some time here, we could make a film. And he was just like, yeah, cool, whatever. I mean, it was just like instant, you know, like letting us into his world. And he had no, you know, there was no hesitation on his part. It was a lot of trust from him, which is, you know, it's hard to get these days. A lot of people, you know, come in with different motives than they say. And, you know, we could have made a piece about a, you know, some kind of dangerous, their fire, you know, like, you know, are they out to like fire code or something, you know? So he was just like super welcoming. And he also kind of looked at it in a way that any kind of buzz about his mall, I mean, he's very passionate about it, could create, you know, maybe people coming to check it out. So they could watch the movie and go, oh, I want to walk around that mall, and they might buy something. He kind of always had that attitude. And in regards to like people not wanting to be in it, everyone was pretty open. You know, it was kind of, some days we hit home runs and some days you'd have some older gentlemen saying, you're not going to film me, buddy, you know, or like asking me what church I go to before they even talk to me. And it was kind of like hit or miss, but honestly, I feel like we got really lucky. And if you go up to somebody and shake their hand, look them in the eye, and kind of just say, hey, you guys are playing chess. Y'all look great. Do you mind if we just spend some time filming with y'all? A lot of times they're just like, yeah, sure. It's weird, but you know, I don't care. It's harder to get them to sign a release form at the end, you know?
Yeah. Might be better to get the release in the beginning.
Seriously. Yeah.
So you've explained how you got access to Mike. What were the challenges you faced, if any, in terms of access to the actual physical space of the mall? He's taking you into these amazing abandoned spaces of JCPenney and Kmart, which just blew my mind seeing them as they were then without anything in them. I'm assuming that you had to go to the mall owner. How did that all work?
You know, the owner of the mall owns a lot of malls, like something like 36 malls. In fact, I think Mike says that in the movie. And, yeah. You know, in some ways it was just like anything else. You know, we had to secure a location release and, you know, deal with any locations to use. And I mean, you know, it took a few phone calls to kind of get on his radar because he's a busy guy. But once we did that, it, you know, and got everything signed, you know, we were good to go to film there.
And then most of the stores that we go into are privately owned, you know, and, you know, once we're in this, you know, this building where, you know, we talked to our lawyer here in town, Stacy Davis, and she kind of let us know the rules of what we can and can't do. And everyone was pretty cool about signing. Everyone signed a location release and they were into it like Robin's Nest. She had been there for, you know, over 25 years. In that space, and you know, I doubt anyone ever approached her about filming. So it was a little strange for her. That what's funny is Robin, who's kind of prominently featured, she was very hesitant in the beginning, and mm-hmm. We had to kind of talk her into doing it. But once we got in there, she kind of looked forward to us coming. I think
one of the moments I thought was really fascinating was talking about the owner. When Mike talks about, well, you know, the owner will get me into another mall, I kept thinking his heart is so into this place, he's just going to leave this and go someplace else. It was a really kind of sad moment in the film for me, at least.
Well, yeah, it's true because, I mean, what you said there, like, we send this off to a few people once we're done editing some. We try not to, like, get a bunch of ton of notes from people because it can get really complicated then because we have, you know, we kind of see what we want to do. But we did send it to some trusted friends and filmmakers. And, you know, half of them said this was, like, the saddest movie they've seen in a long time. Like, not since Melancholia, you know. It was like, I don't know. So we got a lot of reactions, so it's interesting to hear that you caught on to some of Mike's sadness too.
Well, it's sad in a much broader way than that. I mean, what this film really shows is, like, we all sort of know that their malls are declining, but, like, what it means to the people who work there and what it means to the people who go there and what it means to a community. And it really, you know, gives not just voice, but emotion to the intellectual thought that malls are dying and what it means.
It's so great to hear you say that because that's where we were coming from. I mean, I think when we entered into this, like, the sort of blazing sort of nostalgia of the retro mall is shining very brightly everywhere. You know, people are walking around old malls and you see a lot of, you know, Instagram accounts and things with old mall photos, but nothing was really showing, you know, what a mall looks like in 2019 for the people inside of it still, you know. And that was exactly what we wanted to go in and show.
How long did you stay in Jasper and in the mall before you took out the cameras and started to shoot?
I would say it was about 2 weeks of going up there, of just going up there and hanging out and talking to people and getting to know people before that and just explaining that, you know, we kind of did it while we were securing, you know, our location release with the owner. It was kind of like we kind of went around to the Army Recruitment Center. I started dialogue with the Department of Defense to, you know, because we knew we wanted a scene in there because it's kind of, you know, a lot of malls like that have Army Recruitment Centers. So we wanted to include that. So it was kind of like a pre-pro and meet people, I'd say, for, you know, 2 to 3 weeks.
And how long were you actually shooting in the mall?
I think it was about 8 months, right? Eight to nine months, Brett, is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You talk about this nostalgia for malls going back to your childhood. And in your press notes, you directly reference season 3 of the Netflix series Stranger Things, which takes place in one of these 1980s era malls. Do you think malls have a future? From what you've experienced, what is the role of the mall in today's world, and how has that world changed for the people who experience malls and the people who work in malls?
Well, I mean, when you say that, all I can think of is that the mall in my town where I grew up in South Houston was Baybrook Mall. And I went there as a kid. My mama dropped me off I would beg her to drop me off all day. And it had a movie theater. It had a pet store. It had a music store. It had a Aladdin's Castle arcade game. And I could spend all day there and eat. I could do everything that I needed to do there. It was safe. And, you know, it was just like, you know, I did it often and I look forward to it. And I don't, you know, I think the way retail has changed, a Baybrook Mall could have never made it if they hadn't updated and tried to make it look newer and put nicer restaurants and made skylights a part of, you know, the way it looks. It's not yellow anymore. Now it's daylight. There's not fake plants. So I think part of, you know, changing and updating the ways malls kind of facilitate the neighborhood or the surrounding area, kind of, I think you have to adapt. And I think Jasper Mall actually started adapting, like, right, Brad, like the way they started facilitating, like, local businesses. Like, there was, like, Robin's Nest, a flower shop, isn't normally something that you would see in a mall.
Yeah, I think there was a period of time when they were trying to sort of adapt. And to speak to what Brett's saying, I mean, like, that mall in South Houston he's referring to, you know, they adapted by moving a lot of the inside outside. And I think that, you know, shopping is to survive, shopping areas and centers need to feel more boutique and more like you're having an outdoor experience, I think, to survive. Because the mall that I grew up going to in a little north of the one you were referring to is just gone. It's completely dead and empty. And, you know, I don't know how malls, as they have existed in our memory, could adapt to stay alive. But I think
it was a place to hang out.
Yeah, sure. And now people hang out at home so much. Most of our entertainment and things that we consume are done, you know, like on our computers or from, you know, in that way that I can't imagine like just wanting to go hole up somewhere else, you know, all day like we used to when we were young.
I mean, Amazon has certainly changed that. And, you know, people don't get together in a mall. They get together, you know, on Instagram or whatever. So my last question was, what do the characters think of the film? I think you spoke a little bit about this. I'm sure you had a screening. Did you have screening in the mall?
We actually didn't show. We don't normally show our characters the movie unless they ask. We work with an incredible sound mixer, Lawrence Everson. He mixed American Factory and tons of other incredible films. And he does a beautiful 5.1 mix. And really our dream is to have the people that are in the film sit with us in the theater, and we can sit next to them in the way that we dreamed about it and watch it with them.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for chatting with us. I wish you all amazing things with your marvelous movie.
Thank you so much, and keep making films like this. I think it's really important that films like this get made and get shown, because they help us understand the world in a very deep way.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We can move on to the next one. Love Mobile is a German documentary about sex workers on the highway outside of a Volkswagen factory. And we focus on two women specifically, one from Bulgaria and the other is from Nigeria. And then a murder occurs, and that adds a weird element halfway through.
This is from director Ilka Lehrenkraus, and I really, really enjoyed this film. Well, enjoy is the wrong word, because I enjoyed it intellectually, but I really admired the film. I don't know how she got access.
The access is insane. I mean, the Johns or the customers or whatever, they must have agreed to it, but it's...
So many times you're in a scene and you're wondering, how did they agree to let them do that?
I think because sex work is legal in Germany,
right,
there's probably less stigma attached to being filmed in the middle of negotiations. That's all I can think of. And also, Ilka Lehrenkraus must just be a really good negotiator.
And speaking of interesting characters, I mean, the woman, the older lady who runs this like trailer.
Ushi.
I mean, who's just an iron fist, but also kind of a soft hand. I don't know. It's so interesting. The moment where the Christian neighbor wanders up and tries to engage her in a conversation.
Yeah.
This bus is your place. What you make out of it is your business. You sit up front, look at people. You never open the door. You talk with him on the window.
Have a good deal.
No good.
Nicht zu mich nicht.
So, Summer, there's another interview that Bart and I just recorded recently with the director of the opening night film about a father who, the director is Lynn Sachs, and it's this intimate portrait of her father, who's a well-known fixture around Park City. In the film, you learn that he's called the Hugh Hefner of Park City. He's now in his 80s, and he's this sort of hippie-ish guy who's a developer who built quite a lot of structures in Park City and also had quite a lot of children outside of the ones from his original marriage. Now, you had mentioned that you hadn't seen this film, so can you tell us how this got programmed at the festival?
So this was programmed by the Breakouts Committee. After watching so many films for Doc Features every year, I find myself pretty burnt out and usually kind of take a break from watching anything for December and part of January. But I can't wait to watch this one. I'm very excited. But for Doc Features and competition films, we only program first-time directors, which, you know, really limits what we can program. Basically, we're much more limited than other festivals. So we created this category called Breakouts for films by filmmakers who have made features before, but if this is in some way a unique departure from their previous work, or, you know, somehow a meaningful new stage in their career development, then that's what this committee is focused on finding.
Interesting. Bart, what were your thoughts on the film?
I really liked the film a lot. Lynn Sachs is mostly an experimental filmmaker. I mean, she is a video artist. But this really is a documentary first about her life. And I thought the scope of the story from many, many years and the character and her, not only her openness and honesty about it, but her family, all of them, I thought it was really quite revealing about this very interesting, problematic character that they both love and hate at the same time.
Yes, because obviously he's her father and she's had a close relationship to him at times. On the other hand, he's done some things that aren't so great and she covers them all. So yes, it's a complicated relationship and a complicated film.
As far back as I can remember, Dad engaged with the world in ways that inspired, excited, and sometimes confused me. Dad had his own language, and we were expected to speak it. I loved him so much that I agreed to his syntax, his set of rules.
So welcome, Lynn, to The Fog of Truth. Thank you so much for joining us to talk about your wonderful film.
Oh, thank you.
So how did you form the idea of taking all this, shall we say, mishigas of your family and all the years of material you've shot and make it into a film?
I decided to make the film in 1991. So every single shot after that was pretty much created intentionally. It was meant to be in this vessel of this project, of my investigation of who was my dad, who is my dad, what was my relationship to him, who was I as daughter, what was his imprint on me. It just became really, at different points, kind of intimidating to make, but that I just kept shooting. And then I decided about a year and a half ago that the time was right. My dad was getting older, although we all are all getting older at the same rate, and I was getting old. And it was time for me to kind of come to grips with what I was trying to do, and also to write and to create the narration, which was going to be my sort of interior voice in relationship to the film.
Was that really the reason why you decided to stop and finish the film? Your father's getting older. You just said now is the time. Were there any other reasons you felt like you had enough of an arc in your story by then?
I would say, honestly, part of it was the discovery that I had two siblings I hadn't known about at all. Maybe clues. And that seemed like, okay, there's never a closure to a life until a life is over. But that seemed like a kind of realization that I needed to reckon with in a really deep way to articulate my kind of shock about it and also my forgiveness at the same time and I had to do that in a real way. So I thought, why don't I try to grapple with that within the construct of this endeavor?
A lot of documentaries use archival film, and most of that is looking at films of other people. In this case, you are looking at material from enormous different formats, but also looking at you and your family over a long period of time, and you're looking at this revisiting emotionally what's happening in your life. What was it like to deal with the archival material in this film?
So I come from a background of a sort of experimental filmmaking where you make these distinctions between the archive and the found. So I often work with found images, and you can have a kind of like clever, glib, kind of ironic or maybe metaphoric relationship to those images and irreverent. This was the opposite, where I kind of worked through it in a kind of awed way and intimidated way and excited way, because, you know, the way your memory works is not always in line with how the images would reveal. And so also, I have never really been someone who loved watching home movies. So because I knew I had a kind of construct, I knew that I was trying to build a relationship with these images, it kind of drove, I mean, there was so much material because there was all this material I had shot. Then my brother Ira, who's also a filmmaker, had collected some material when he went on a trip with my dad to Russia. And then my father had occasionally shot home, like what you would really call home movie material. So I had to go through those and also think about that every image that in an archive has a point of view. So who is it that is looking at this? Who is it that is like screening the world or filtering the world?
To some degree, your father, Ira Sachs Sr., clearly does what he wants and with whom he wants, regardless of how others feel. That's an oversimplification, but that certainly is part of his trajectory in life. Why do you think so many people over the years have fallen under his spell?
It's interesting that you say that because some, good women friends of mine do not talk to their fathers. That for whatever reason, back when they were teenagers or back, as they were becoming adults, I have two good women friends who are in that category. You know, they said, enough, I can't deal with this, goodbye. And I guess I could have been one of those, but there was always something about my father that was so deeply loving and attentive and respectful and supportive to me. And it's just that
I'm particularly interested in sort of why you think other people, like he seems to have this spell that he casts on.
Like a charisma. Yeah. And also, usually we associate people with charisma as being very loquacious, like chattering all the time and storytelling and everybody just wants to listen. But he had a much more quiet way of being a very unusual person, being someone. I think that he followed his own path. You know, he people were drawn to that and still maybe. I mean, he lives a much quieter life right now, but I think it was a charisma and he wasn't an artist, but his life was constantly inventive, you know, and from transforming in the 60s when we were kids, transforming a school bus into like a mobile hippie party bus or, you know, that anybody could get on. And also my dad always kind of crossed class, like different sectors from business sector to kind of like underground arties. And that was something that was appealing, like the people who were in more of a sort of middle class suburban life would think, oh, you attach to Ira and then you're going to see some like the underbelly and vice versa. There was like this total fluid. I always said my dad was like the least class conscious person ever. And hopefully that was something that I embraced myself. I don't know. And I think that that kind of fluidity was very seductive.
So for a film that is so incredibly personal, why did you choose to not edit yourself and how did you work with your editor?
So my editor, Rebecca Schappes, had been a student of mine a few years ago, and she'd actually never edited anything even close to this kind of project. But the thing was that I kept finding obstacles on several different levels. I would look at the footage and I would always think that I had to explain the context. I needed an audience to understand who everybody was and where they came from and where they went afterwards. And she was always reminding me that this was a cosmos we were creating and that the cosmos had its own limitations like a movie does. And so that was one thing. The other thing was that I was very, very critical of the material as it had degraded. And as we moved closer to the digital realm, I would look at the film that I'd shot in mini DV or Hi8 and I would think, people won't want to look at this. And so she would help me to kind of excavate that material. And together we came to the conclusion that audiences were actually sick of beautiful images, like perfectly pristine digital images, and wanted to see, in an archaeological way, I guess, wanted to see the treasures of another era and also that the treasures of that period and how they were documented, and not to think that we have to see the digital from the past. Like the past was perceived in a certain kind of way. Why not recognize that? Like that it's of its time. That's what it is. She would help me to see that the material was of its time instead of my being so critical of what I had in this, like in these boxes and boxes of film.
I'm curious, how you see your relationship to your father changing, if at all, over the course of making the film. Did you see your relationship or your impressions, opinions of your father change in the making of the film?
So I think in my 20s in particular, I was extremely judgmental. And part of that was finding my way as a woman and then finding out, like, what is it to be a feminist? Like, you know, do you expect all men to follow a code that, like, that I would expect in my partner or my husband? My father came with all the attentiveness to what women are and can be and can fulfill. And also there were points where, you know, where I felt like I didn't know whether he was capable of being having a deep relationship, like a deep human-to-human relationship. And I started to see that even if he didn't have that with his partners in life, that he could have it with me. And especially in the last few years, he would come and live at our house for a few weeks at a time while we were shooting. And so I got to see his rhythms, not so much under his control, but under our control or our shared rhythm. And that was like, it was the last two, he would come to New York all the time, but he would stay in a hotel, and to have him live with me made it more human.
So then following up on that, how do you think that relationship and how you feel about him will change as you have the premiere at Slam Dance and as you travel around with the film and he lives with you in a completely different way?
You know, I've been making like documentary and experimental documentaries for a really long time, and they show quite a lot about my life, but plenty of other works. And in the kind of paradigm of documentary, you open doors and you open other people's doors to look into their lives. And that's kind of like a mark of a success. Well, you really got in that door. Good job. And I felt like it was my time to open my door. And this is not a hybrid work. And I've made plenty, like recently, I'm very interested in hybrid. This is my life, but I almost feel like it was the only way to sort of equal the scales, because I had, you know, like to understand what it is to be the subject, I had to find my platform that way and then turn the camera on myself, hopefully not just in a selfie way, but because the thing about a selfie is you frame it and then you smile. This isn't always a smile. And my dad is within that frame and in foreground, background, you know, things become in focus and out of focus. But I, you know, I do feel vulnerable, honestly. And I feel vulnerable for both of us or for my whole family. But I also feel like hopefully I've opened up something where people would think not exclusively about our family, but about their own relationships. So that might open up something else, which would be conversations about, you know, things that you have problems with in your own personal family universe. And then you, instead of saying, well, that planet doesn't exist anymore, or I forgot about that, or that one disappeared, that you have to kind of reckon with it all.
Since your dad is such a well-known figure in Park City, as you make clear in the film, and indeed he's been called the, quote, Hugh Hefner of Park City, unquote, what kind of reaction to your film are you anticipating at its opening night premiere at Slam Dance?
I think that people will actually be interested and maybe kind of relieved to get the bigger picture on Ira Sachs. But also people from Park City bring their own memories of him. And he, as I said, he's alive, but they have their own experiences. And actually, my dad was arrested for marijuana. Now, you know, people kind of are very blasé about that, but they might remember that he did community service in a farmer's market for months in order to rectify that situation. So there are places where they'll have their own, they'll bring their own experiences or anecdotes, and they probably will be people who say, "Well, I didn't know that all of that happened." But that's the thing about each of us. I mean, we each have things that we share in a very visible or public way, and then we have other parts of ourselves. But together, the gestalt makes us into like the nuanced people that we are. So maybe this will move him away from being a legend, which somebody might say about my dad to being just quite human.
Well, whatever the reaction, I wish you all the best with the film. I found it quite fascinating, and thank you for joining both Bart and me here on The Fog of Truth.
Thank you so much.
Summer, what have you missed by not being part of this podcast? Is there anything you've missed about this?
Yeah, I miss talking about docs with you guys. And doing programming this year for Slamdance reminded me. I mean, I love the committee meetings. That's like my favorite part of the whole year, is just like nerding out about films. And so I definitely do miss our regular conversations. And I've loved hearing your guys' thoughts about these films today. That was cool.
Well, we've missed having you on the show, and it's been so great to have you back for this episode. For our regular listeners, we'll return to our regularly scheduled format in episode 802, which will be dropping a week after this one. But that concludes this amazing episode 801.
Of Truth musical theme was composed by Jeremiah Moore, composed for the podcast and used by permission. Transitional music is by Bells. Thank you to Christopher Ernst. Editing and show notes by the magnificent Christopher Llewellyn Reed, who takes all the stupid things I say out of this podcast, except sometimes. Contact info, if you have things to tell us, please send them to disinfo@fogoftruth.com. Thank you very much, Summer, for being with us. Thank you for Chris for organizing so much and making this a wonderful episode.
And thank you, Bart, for all of your terrific contributions.
I actually did something useful today. Now I can go to sleep.
I think this gives a face to Sasquatch. It's the closest thing people have.
There might be somebody one day that walks up and sees that model and decides to give me what's in his freezer. That is my ultimate goal.